Fortunately, this story doesn't end with physicians suddenly slapping themselves on their collective forehead and putting their beliefs to experimental tests. The idea of randomized controlled trials was painfully slow to catch on, and it was only after World War II that the first serious trials were attempted. They delivered excellent results. But still, the physicians and scientists who promoted the modernization of medicine routinely found that the medical establishment wasn't interested, or was even hostile to their efforts. Too much that was being done in the name of healthcare lacked scientific validation. Archie Cochran complained about medicine in the 1950s and 1960s, and the National Health Service, the British healthcare system, had far too little interest in proving and promoting what was effective. Physicians and the institutions they controlled didn't want to let go of the idea that their judgment alone revealed the truth, so they kept doing what they did because they had always done it that way, and they were backed up by respected authority. They didn't need scientific validation. They just knew. Cochran despised this attitude. He called it the God complex. When hospitals created cardiac care units to treat patients recovering from heart attacks, Cochran proposed a randomized trial to determine whether the new units delivered better results than the old treatment, which was to send the patient home for monitoring and bed rest. Physicians balked. It was obvious the cardiac care units were superior, they said, and denying patients the best care would be unethical. But Cochran was not a man to back down. As a prison camp physician treating fellow POWs during World War II, he often stood up to the authorities. On occasion, he loudly berated trigger-happy German guards. So Cochran got his trial. Some patients, randomly selected, were sent to the cardiac care units, while others were sent home for monitoring and bed rest. Partway through the trial, Cochran met with a group of the cardiologists who had tried to stop his experiment. He told them that he had preliminary results. The difference in outcomes between the two treatments was not statistically significant, he emphasized, but it appeared that patients might do slightly better in the cardiac care units. They were vociferous in their abuse. Archie, they said, we always thought you were unethical. You must stop the trial at once. But then Cochran revealed he had played a little trick. He had reversed the results. Home care had done slightly better than the cardiac units. There was dead silence, and I felt rather sick because they were, after all, my medical colleagues. Unusually high heart disease rates among prisoners drew Cochran's attention to the justice system, where he encountered the same attitude among prison wardens, judges, and home office officials. What people didn't grasp is that the only alternative to a controlled experiment that delivers real insight is an uncontrolled experiment that produces merely the illusion of insight. Cochran cited the Thatcher government's short, sharp shock approach to young offenders, which called for brief incarceration in Spartan jails governed by strict rules. Did it work? The government had simply implemented it throughout the justice system, making it impossible to answer. If the policy was introduced and crime went down, that might mean the policy worked, or perhaps crime went down for any of 100 other possible reasons. If crime went up, that might show the policy was useless or even harmful, or it might mean crime would have risen even more but for the beneficial effects of the policy. Naturally, politicians would claim otherwise. Those in power would say it worked. Their opponents would say it failed. But nobody would really know. The politicians would be blind men arguing over the colors of the rainbow. If the government had subjected its policy to a randomized controlled trial, then we might, by now, have known its true worth and be some way ahead in our thinking, Cochran observed. But it hadn't. It had just assumed that its policy would work as expected. This was the same toxic brew of ignorance and confidence that had kept medicine in the Dark Ages for millennia. Cochran's frustration is palpable in his autobiography. Why couldn't people see that intuition alone was no basis for firm conclusions? It was bewildering. Yet when this skeptical scientist was told by an eminent physician that his body was riddled with cancer, and he should prepare to die, Archie Cochrane meekly acquiesced. He did not think. That's just one man's subjective judgment. It could be wrong. So I'll wait for the pathologist's report. And why did the surgeon cut out my muscle before hearing from the pathologist anyway? Cochrane treated the physician's conclusion as fact and prepared to die. So there are two riddles. First, there is Cochrane's modest point that much more than intuition is needed before we draw firm conclusions. It is so obviously true. Why did people resist it? Why, specifically, did the specialist not think to wait to hear from the pathologist before removing a swath of Cochrane's flesh? Then there is the puzzle of Cochrane himself. Why did a man who stressed the importance of not rushing to judgment rush to judgment about whether he had terminal cancer? Thinking about thinking. It is natural to identify our thinking with the ideas, images, plans, and feelings that flow through consciousness. What else could it be? If I ask, why did you buy that car? You can trot out reasons. Good mileage, cute style, great price. But you can only share thoughts by introspecting, that is, by turning your attention inward and examining the contents of your mind. And introspection can only capture a tiny fraction of the complex processes whirling inside your head and behind your decisions. In describing how we think and decide, modern psychologists often deploy a dual-system model that partitions our mental universe into two domains. System 2 is the familiar realm of conscious thought. It consists of everything we choose to focus on. By contrast, System 1 is largely a stranger to us. It is the realm of automatic perceptual and cognitive operations, like those you are running right now to transform the print on this page into a meaningful sentence, or to hold the book while reaching for a glass and taking a sip. We have no awareness of these rapid-fire processes, but we could not function without them. We would shut down. The numbering of the two systems is not arbitrary. System 1 comes first. It is fast and constantly running in the background. If a question is asked and you instantly know the answer, it sprang from System 1. System 2 is charged with interrogating that answer. Does it stand up to scrutiny? Is it backed by evidence? This process takes time and effort, which is why the standard routine in decision-making is this. First, System 1 delivers an answer, and only then can System 2 get involved, starting with an examination of what System 1 decided. Whether System 2 actually will get involved is another matter. Try answering this. A bat and ball together cost $1.10. The bat costs a dollar more than the ball. How much does the ball cost? If you are like just about everybody who has ever read this famous question, you instantly had an answer, 10 cents. You didn't think carefully to get that. You didn't calculate anything. It just appeared. For that, you can thank System 1. Quick and easy, no effort required. But is 10 cents right? Think about the question carefully. You probably realized a couple of things. First, conscious thought is demanding. Thinking the problem through requires sustained focus and takes an eternity relative to the snap judgment you got with a quick look. Second, 10 cents is wrong. It feels right, but it's wrong. In fact, it's obviously wrong if you give it a sober second thought. The bat and ball question is one item in an ingenious psychological measure, the cognitive reflection test, which has shown that most people, including very smart people, aren't very reflective. They read the question, think 10 cents, and scribble down 10 cents as their final answer without thinking carefully. So they never discover the mistake, let alone come up with a correct answer, 5 cents. That is normal human behavior. We tend to go with strong hunches. System 1 follows a primitive psychologic. If it feels true, it is. In the Paleolithic world in which our brains evolved, that's not a bad way of making decisions. Gathering all evidence and mulling it over may be the best way to produce accurate answers. But a hunter-gatherer who consults statistics on lions before deciding whether to worry about the shadow moving in the grass isn't likely to live long enough to bequeath his accuracy-maximizing genes to the next generation. Snap judgments are sometimes essential. As Daniel Kahneman puts it, System 1 is designed to jump to conclusions from little evidence. So what about that shadow in the long grass? Should you worry? Well, can you recall a lion emerging from the grass and pouncing on someone? If that memory comes to you easily, it is not the sort of thing people tend to forget, you will conclude lion attacks are common, and then start to worry. Spelling out this process makes it sound ponderous, slow, and calculating, but it can happen entirely within System 1, making it automatic, fast, and complete within a few tenths of a second. You see the shadow, snap, you are frightened, and running. That's the availability heuristic, one of many System 1 operations, or heuristics, discovered by Daniel Kahneman, his collaborator Amos Tversky, and other researchers in the fast-growing science of judgment and choice. A defining feature of intuitive judgment is its insensitivity to the quality of the evidence on which the judgment is based. It has to be that way. System 1 can only do its job of delivering strong conclusions at lightning speed if it never pauses to wonder whether the evidence at hand is flawed or inadequate, or if there is better evidence elsewhere. It must treat the available evidence as reliable and sufficient. These tacit assumptions are so vital to System 1 that Kahneman gave them an ungainly but oddly memorable label, WYSIATI. What you see is all there is. Of course, System 1 can't conclude whatever it wants. The human brain demands order. The world must make sense, which means we must be able to explain what we see and think. And we usually can, because we are creative confabulators hardwired to invent stories that impose coherence on the world. Imagine you're sitting at a table in a research lab, looking at rows of pictures. You pick one, a picture of a shovel. Why are you pointing at that? Of course, you can't answer without more information. But if you were actually at that table, with your finger pointing at a picture of a shovel, simply saying, "I don't know," would be a lot harder than you might think. Sane people are expected to have sensible-sounding reasons for their actions. It is awkward to tell others, especially white lab-coated neuroscientists, "I have no idea why. I just am." In celebrated research, Michael Gazzaniga designed a bizarre situation in which sane people did indeed have no idea why they were doing what they were doing. His test subjects were split-brain patients, meaning that the left and right hemispheres of their brains could not communicate with each other because the connection between them, the corpus callosum, had been surgically severed, traditionally as a treatment for severe epilepsy. These people are remarkably normal, but their condition allows researchers to communicate directly with only one hemisphere of their brain by showing an image to only the left or right field of vision without sharing the communication with the other hemisphere. It's like talking to two different people. In this case, the left field of vision, which reports to the right hemisphere, was shown a picture of a snowstorm, and the person was asked to point to the picture that related to it. So he quite reasonably pointed at the shovel. The right field of vision, which reports to the left hemisphere, was shown an image of a chicken claw, and the person was then asked why his hand was pointed at a shovel. The left hemisphere had no idea why. But the person didn't say, "I don't know." Instead, he made up a story. "Oh, that's simple," one patient said. "The chicken claw goes with the chicken, and you need a shovel to clean out the chicken shed." This compulsion to explain arises with clock-like regularity every time a stock market closes, and a journalist says something like, "The Dow rose 95 points today on news that..." A quick check will often reveal that the news that supposedly drove the market came out well after the market had risen. But that minimal level of scrutiny is seldom applied. It's a rare day when a journalist says, "The market rose today for any one of 100 different reasons, or a mix of them, so no one knows." Instead, like a split-brain patient asked why he is pointing at a picture of a shovel, when he has no idea why, the journalist conjures a plausible story from whatever is at hand. The explanatory urge is mostly a good thing. Indeed, it is the propulsive force behind all human efforts to comprehend reality. The problem is that we move too fast from confusion and uncertainty. I have no idea why my hand is pointed at a picture of a shovel, to a clear and confident conclusion. Oh, that's simple. Without spending any time in between. This is one possible explanation, but there are others. In 2011, when a massive car bomb killed 8 people and injured over 200 in Oslo, the capital of Norway, the first reaction was shock. This was Oslo, one of the most peaceful and prosperous cities on the planet. Speculation erupted on the internet and cable news. It had to be radical Islamists. It was a car bomb intended to kill as many as possible. And the car had been parked outside the office tower where the prime minister works. It had to be Islamists. Just like the London, Madrid, and Bali bombings. Just like 9/11. People rushed to Google to see if they could find supporting information. They succeeded. Norway has soldiers in Afghanistan as part of the NATO mission. Norway has a poorly integrated Muslim community. A radical Muslim preacher had been charged with incitement the week before. Then came word that an even more shocking crime had been committed not long after the bombing. It was a mass shooting, dozens dead, at a summer camp for young people run by the ruling Labour Party. Everything fit. These were coordinated attacks by Islamist terrorists. No doubt about it. Whether the terrorists were homegrown or linked to Al-Qaeda remained to be seen, but it was obvious the perpetrators had to be extremist Muslims. As it turned out, there was only one perpetrator. His name is Anders Breivik. He isn't Muslim. He hates Muslims. Breivik's attacks were aimed at a government that he felt had betrayed Norway with its multiculturalist policies. After Breivik's arrest, many people accused those who had rushed to judgment of Islamophobia. Not without reason, as some of them had seemed all too eager to blame Muslims in general. But given the few facts known at the time, and the history of mass atrocity terrorism in the preceding decade, it was reasonable to suspect Islamist terrorists. A scientist would describe that as a plausible hypothesis. But a scientist would have handled that plausible hypothesis very differently. Like everyone else, scientists have intuitions. Indeed, hunches and flashes of insight, the sense that something is true even if you can't prove it, have been behind countless breakthroughs. The interplay between System 1 and System 2 can be subtle and creative. But scientists are trained to be cautious. They know that no matter how tempting it is to anoint a pet hypothesis as the truth, alternative explanations must get a hearing. And they must seriously consider the possibility that their initial hunch is wrong. In fact, in science, the best evidence that a hypothesis is true is often an experiment designed to prove the hypothesis is false, but which fails to do so. Scientists must be able to answer the question, what would convince me I am wrong? If they can't, it's a sign they have grown too attached to their beliefs. The key is doubt. Scientists can feel just as strongly as anyone else that they know the truth. But they know they must set feelings aside and replace it with finely measured degrees of doubt. Doubt that can be reduced, although never to zero, by better evidence from better studies. Such scientific caution runs against the grain of human nature. As the post-Oslo speculation reveals, our natural inclination is to grab on to the first plausible explanation and happily gather supportive evidence without checking its reliability. That is what psychologists call confirmation bias. We rarely seek out evidence that undercuts our first explanation, and when that evidence is shoved under our noses, we become motivated skeptics, finding reasons, however tenuous, to belittle it or throw it out entirely. Recall Galen's sublime confidence that his wonderful treatment cured everyone who took it, except the incurable cases who died. That was pure confirmation bias. If the patient is cured, it is evidence my treatment works. If the patient dies, it means nothing. This is a poor way to build an accurate mental model of a complicated world, but it's a superb way to satisfy the brain's desire for order, because it yields tidy explanations with no loose ends. Everything is clear, consistent, and settled. And the fact that it all fits gives us confidence that we know the truth. It is wise to take admissions of uncertainty seriously, Daniel Kahneman noted. But declarations of high confidence mainly tell you that an individual has constructed a coherent story in his mind, not necessarily that the story is true. Bait and switch. When the eminence specialist cut into Archie Cochran's armpit, he saw tissue that appeared riddled with cancer. Was it? It made sense that it would be. There was the lump in the patient's armpit, the carcinoma on his hand. And years before, Cochran had been involved in research that had exposed him to X-rays, which was why the first doctor had urged him to see the specialist. It all fit. This was cancer, no doubt about it. And no need to wait for the pathologist's report before removing one of Cochran's muscles and advising the patient that he hadn't long to live. Archie Cochran's skeptical defenses folded, because Cochran found the specialist's story as intuitively compelling as the specialist did. But another mental process was likely at work as well. Formally, it's called attribute substitution, but I call it bait and switch. When faced with a hard question, we often surreptitiously replace it with an easy one. Should I worry about the shadow in the long grass? Is a hard question. Without more data, it may be unanswerable. So we substitute an easier question. Can I easily recall a lion attacking someone from the long grass? That question becomes a proxy for the original question. And if the answer is yes to the second question, the answer to the first also becomes yes. So the availability heuristic, like Kahneman's other heuristics, is essentially a bait-and-switch maneuver. And just as the availability heuristic is usually an unconscious System 1 activity, so too is bait-and-switch. Of course, we aren't always oblivious to the machinations of our minds. If someone asks about climate change, we may say, I have no training in climatology and haven't read any of the science. If I tried to answer based on what I know, I'd make a mess of it. The knowledgeable people are the climatologists. So I'll substitute, do most climatologists think climate change is real? For, is climate change real? An ordinary person told by an eminent cancer specialist that she has terminal cancer may engage in the same conscious bait and switch and just accept what the doctor says is true. But Archie Cochran was no ordinary fellow. He was a prominent physician. He knew that the pathologist hadn't reported. He knew better than anyone that physicians are often too sure of themselves and that this God complex can lead them to make terrible mistakes. And yet he immediately accepted that what the specialist said was the true and final word. Because, I suspect, Cochran unconsciously substituted, is this the sort of person who should know if I have cancer? For the question, do I have cancer? The answer was, of course, he is an eminent cancer specialist. He saw the cancerous flesh with his own eyes. This is exactly the sort of person who should know whether I have cancer. So Cochran acquiesced. I realize I am rocking no one's mental universe by saying that people often jump to judgment. Anyone who has spent time around humans knows that. But that is telling. We know we should slow down and think before drawing firm conclusions. And yet, when we are faced with a problem and a seemingly sensible solution springs to mind, we bypass System 2 and declare, the answer is 10 cents. No one is immune. Not even skeptics like Archie Cochran. We could call this automatic, nearly effortless mode of thinking about the world the default setting, but that won't do. Default suggests we can flip the switch to something else. We can't. Like it or not, System 1 operations keep humming nonstop beneath the babbling brook of consciousness. A better metaphor involves vision. The instant we wake up and look past the tip of our nose, sights and sounds flow to the brain and System 1 is engaged. This perspective is subjective, unique to each of us. Only you can see the world from the tip of your own nose. So let's call it the tip of your nose perspective. Blinking and thinking. As imperfect as the view from the tip of your nose may be, you shouldn't discount it entirely. Popular books often draw a dichotomy between intuition and analysis. Blink versus think, and pick one or the other as the way to go. I am more of a thinker than a blinker, but blink-think is another false dichotomy. The choice isn't either or, it is how to blend them in evolving situations. That conclusion is not as inspiring as a simple exhortation to take one path or the other, but it has the advantage of being true, as the pioneering researchers behind both perspectives came to understand. While Daniel Kahneman and Amos Tversky were documenting System 1's failings, another psychologist, Gary Klein, was examining decision-making among professionals like the commanders of firefighting teams and discovering that snap judgments can work astonishingly well. One commander told Klein about going to a routine kitchen fire and ordering his men to stand in the living room and hose down the flames. The fire subsided at first, but roared back. The commander was baffled. He'd also noticed the living room was surprisingly hot, given the size of the kitchen fire. And why was it so quiet? A fire capable of generating that much heat should make more noise. A vague feeling of unease came over the commander, and he ordered everyone out of the house. Just as the firefighters reached the street, the floor in the living room collapsed, because the real source of the fire was in the basement, not the kitchen. How had the commander known they were in terrible danger? He told Klein he had ESP, extrasensory perception. But that was just the story he told himself to cover up the fact that he didn't know how he knew. He just knew. The hallmark of an intuitive judgment. Drawing such seemingly different conclusions about snap judgments, Kahneman and Klein could have hunkered down and fired off rival polemics. But, like good scientists, they got together to solve the puzzle. "We agree on most of the issues that matter," they concluded in a 2009 paper. There is nothing mystical about an accurate intuition like the fire commander's. It's pattern recognition. With training or experience, people can encode patterns deep in their memories in vast number and intricate detail, such as the estimated 50,000 to 100,000 chess positions that top players have in their repertoire. If something doesn't fit a pattern, like a kitchen fire giving off more heat than a kitchen fire should, a competent expert senses it immediately. But as we see every time someone spots the Virgin Mary in burnt toast or in mold on a church wall, our pattern recognition ability comes at the cost of susceptibility to false positives. This, plus the many other ways in which the tip-of-your-nose perspective can generate perceptions that are clear, compelling, and wrong, means intuition can fail as spectacularly as it can work. Whether intuition generates delusion or insight depends on whether you work in a world full of valid cues you can unconsciously register for future use. For example, it is very likely that there are early indications that a building is about to collapse in a fire, or that an infant will soon show obvious symptoms of infection, Kahneman and Klein wrote. On the other hand, it is unlikely that there is publicly available information that could be used to predict how well a particular stock will do. If such valid information existed, the price of the stock would already reflect it. Thus, we have more reason to trust the intuition of an experienced fireground commander about the stability of a building, or the intuitions of a nurse about an infant, than to trust the intuitions of a stockbroker. Learning the cues is a matter of opportunity and effort. Sometimes learning the cues is easy. A child does not need thousands of examples to learn to discriminate dogs from cats. But other patterns are much harder to master, like the estimated 10,000 hours of practice it takes to learn those 50,000 to 100,000 chess patterns. Without those opportunities to learn, a valid intuition can only be due to a lucky accident, or to magic, Kahneman and Klein conclude, and we do not believe in magic. But there is a catch. As Kahneman and Klein noted, it's often hard to know when there are enough valid cues to make intuition work. And even where it clearly can, caution is advisable. "Often I cannot explain a certain move, only know that it feels right, and it seems that my intuition is right more often than not," observed the Norwegian prodigy Magnus Carlsen, the world chess champion and the highest-ranked player in history. "If I study a position for an hour, then I am usually going in loops, and I'm probably not going to come up with something useful. I usually know what I'm going to do after 10 seconds. The rest is double-checking." Carlsen respects his intuition, as well he should, but he also does a lot of double-checking, because he knows that sometimes intuition can let him down, and conscious thought can improve his judgment. That's excellent practice. The tip of your nose perspective can work wonders, but it can also go terribly awry. So if you have the time to think before making a big decision, do so. And be prepared to accept that what seems obviously true now may turn out to be false later. It is hard to argue with advice that feels about as controversial as a fortune cookie platitude. But tip-of-your-nose illusions are often so convincing that we bypass the advice and go with our gut. Consider a forecast made by Peggy Noonan, the Wall Street Journal columnist and former speechwriter for Ronald Reagan, the day before the presidential election of 2012. "It will be a Romney victory," Noonan wrote. Her conclusion was based on the big numbers turning out to Romney rallies. "The candidate looks happy and grateful," Noonan observed. And someone who attended a campaign stop had told Noonan about the intensity and joy of the crowd. Add it up, Noonan concluded, and the vibrations are right. It's easy to mock Noonan's vibrations. But who among us hasn't felt mistaken certainty that an election or some other event was going to break one way or another because it just felt that way? You may not have said, "The vibrations are right," but the thinking is the same. That's the power of the tip-of-your-nose perspective. It is so persuasive that for thousands of years, physicians did not doubt their convictions, causing unnecessary suffering on a gargantuan scale. Progress only really began when physicians accepted that the view from the tip of their nose was not enough to determine what works. All too often, forecasting in the 21st century looks too much like 19th century medicine. There are theories, assertions, and arguments. There are famous figures, as confident as they are well compensated. But there is little experimentation, or anything that could be called science. So we know much less than most people realize, and we pay the price. Although bad forecasting rarely leads as obviously to harm as does bad medicine, it steers us subtly toward bad decisions, and all that flows from them, including monetary losses, missed opportunities, unnecessary suffering, even war and death. Happily, physicians now know the cure for all this. It is a tablespoon of doubt. Chapter 3. Keeping Score. When physicians finally learn to doubt themselves, they turn to randomized controlled trials to scientifically test which treatments work. Bringing the rigor of measurement to forecasting might seem easier to do. Collect forecasts, judge their accuracy, add the numbers. That's it. In no time, we'll know how good Tom Friedman really is. But it's not nearly so simple. Consider a forecast Steve Ballmer made in 2007, when he was CEO of Microsoft. "There's no chance that the iPhone is going to get any significant market share. No chance." Ballmer's forecast is infamous. Google Ballmer and Worst Tech Predictions, or Bing it, as Ballmer would prefer, and you will see it enshrined in the Forecasting Hall of Shame, along with such classics as the president of Digital Equipment Corporation declaring in 1977 that there is no reason anyone would want a computer in their home. And that seems fitting, because Ballmer's forecast looks spectacularly wrong. As the author of The 10 Worst Tech Predictions of All Time noted in 2013, the iPhone commands 42% of U.S. smartphone market share and 13.1% worldwide. That's pretty significant. As another journalist wrote, when Ballmer announced his departure from Microsoft in 2013, "The iPhone alone now generates more revenue than all of Microsoft." But parse Ballmer's forecast carefully. The key term is significant market share. What qualifies as significant? Ballmer didn't say. And which market was he talking about? North America? The world? And the market for what? Smartphones or mobile phones in general? All these unanswered questions add up to a big problem. The first step in learning what works in forecasting and what doesn't is to judge forecasts. And to do that, we can't make assumptions about what the forecast means. We have to know. There can't be any ambiguity about whether a forecast is accurate or not, and Balmer's forecast is ambiguous. Sure, it looks wrong. It feels wrong. There is a strong case to be made that it is wrong. But is it wrong beyond all reasonable doubt? I don't blame the reader for thinking this is too lawyerly, a tad too reminiscent of Bill Clinton's infamous, "It depends on what the meaning of the word is." After all, Balmer's meaning seems plain, even if a literal reading of his words doesn't support that. But consider his full statement, in context, in an April 2007 interview with USA Today. "There's no chance that the iPhone is going to get any significant market share. No chance. It's a $500 subsidized item. They may make a lot of money. But if you actually look at the 1.3 billion phones that get sold, I'd prefer to have our software in 60% or 70% or 80% of them than I would to have 2% or 3%, which is what Apple might get." That clarifies some things. For one, Balmer was clearly referring to the global mobile phone market. So it's wrong to measure his forecast against U.S. or global smartphone market share. Using data from the Gartner IT Consulting Group, I calculated that the iPhone's share of global mobile phone sales in the third quarter of 2013 was roughly 6%. That's higher than the 2% or 3% Balmer predicted. But unlike the truncated version so often quoted, it's not laugh-out-loud wrong. Note also that Balmer didn't say the iPhone would be a bust for Apple. Indeed, he said, "They may make a lot of money." But still there is ambiguity. How much more than 2% or 3% of the global mobile phone market would the iPhone have to capture to be deemed significant? Balmer didn't say. And how much money was he talking about when he said Apple could earn a lot of money? Again, he didn't say. So how wrong was Steve Ballmer's forecast? His tone was brash and dismissive. In the USA Today interview, he seems to scoff at Apple. But his words were more nuanced than his tone, and too ambiguous for us to declare with certainty that his forecast was wrong. Much less so spectacularly wrong, it belongs in the forecasting hall of shame. It is far from unusual that a forecast that at first looks as clear as a freshly washed window proves too opaque to be conclusively judged right or wrong. Consider the open letter sent to Ben Bernanke, then the chairman of the Federal Reserve, in November 2010, signed by a long list of economists and commentators, including the Harvard economic historian Neil Ferguson and Amity Schlaes of the Council on Foreign Relations. The letter calls on the Federal Reserve to stop its policy of large-scale asset purchases, known as quantitative easing, because it risks currency debasement and inflation. The advice was ignored, and quantitative easing continued. But in the years that followed, the U.S. dollar wasn't debased, and inflation didn't rise. The investor and commentator Barry Ritholtz wrote in 2013 that the signatories had been proved terribly wrong. Many others agreed. But there was an obvious response. Wait, it hasn't happened yet. But it will. Ritholtz and the critics might argue that in the context of the 2010 debate, the letter writers expected currency debasement and inflation in the next 2 or 3 years, if quantitative easing went ahead. Perhaps, but that is not what they wrote. The letter says nothing about the time frame. It wouldn't matter if Ritholtz waited until 2014 or 2015 or 2016. No matter how much time passed, someone could always say, "Just wait, it's coming." It also isn't clear how much the dollar would have to fall and inflation rise to count as currency debasement and inflation. Worse, the letter says a falling dollar and rising inflation is a risk. That suggests it's not certain to follow. So if we read the forecast literally, it is saying debasement and inflation may follow or they may not, which means that if they do not follow, the forecast is not necessarily wrong. That's surely not what the authors intended to communicate, and it's not how people read the statement at the time. But that is what it says. So here are two forecasts of the sort we routinely encounter. They are serious attempts by smart people to grapple with big issues. Their meaning seems clear. When time passes, their accuracy seems obvious. But it's not. For various reasons, it's impossible to say these forecasts are right or wrong beyond all dispute. The truth is elusive. Judging forecasts is much harder than often supposed, a lesson I learned the hard way, from extensive and exasperating experience. A Holocaust will occur. In the early 1980s, many thoughtful people saw mushroom clouds in humanity's future. If we are honest with ourselves, we have to admit that unless we rid ourselves of our nuclear arsenals, a Holocaust not only might occur but will occur, wrote Jonathan Schell in his influential book, The Fate of the Earth. If not today, then tomorrow. If not this year, then the next. Opposition to the arms race brought millions to the streets of cities across the Western world. In June 1982, an estimated 700,000 people marched in New York City in one of the biggest demonstrations in American history. In 1984, with grants from the Carnegie and MacArthur Foundations, the National Research Council, the research arm of the United States National Academy of Sciences, convened a distinguished panel charged with nothing less than preventing nuclear war. The panelists included three Nobel laureates, the physicist Charles Townes, the economist Kenneth Arrow, and the unclassifiable Herbert Simon, and an array of other luminaries, including the mathematical psychologist Amos Tversky. I was by far the least impressive member of the panel, a 30-year-old political psychologist just promoted to associate professor at the University of California, Berkeley. I owed my seat at the table not to a glorious career of achievement, but rather to a quirky research program, which happened to be germane to the panel's mission. The panel did its due diligence. It invited a range of experts, intelligence analysts, military officers, government officials, arms control experts, and Sovietologists to discuss the issues. They too were an impressive bunch, deeply informed, intelligent, articulate, and pretty confident that they knew what was happening and where we were heading. On the basic facts, at least, there was agreement. The long-serving Soviet leader, Leonid Brezhnev, had died in 1982 and been replaced by a frail old man who soon died and was replaced by another, Konstantin Chernenko, who was also expected to die soon. There was both agreement and disagreement about what would come next. Liberals and conservatives alike largely expected the next Soviet leader to be another stern Communist Party man. But they disagreed on why things would work out that way. Liberal experts were sure that President Ronald Reagan's hard line was strengthening Kremlin hardliners, which would bring a neo-Stalinist retrenchment and worsening relations between the superpowers. Experts of a conservative bent thought that the Soviet system had pretty much perfected the art of totalitarian self-reproduction. Hence, the new boss would be the same as the old boss, and the Soviet Union would continue to threaten world peace by supporting insurgencies and invading its neighbors. They were equally confident in their views. The experts were right about Chernenko. He died in March 1985. But then the train of history hit a curve, and as Karl Marx once quipped, when that happens, the intellectuals fall off. Within hours of Chernenko's death, the Politburo anointed Mikhail Gorbachev. An energetic and charismatic 54-year-old, the next general secretary of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union. Gorbachev changed direction swiftly and sharply. His policies of glasnost, openness, and perestroika, restructuring, liberalized the Soviet Union. Gorbachev also sought to normalize relations with the United States and reverse the arms race. Ronald Reagan responded cautiously, then enthusiastically, and in just a few years, the world went from the prospect of nuclear war to a new era in which many people, including the Soviet and American leaders, saw a glimmering chance of eliminating nuclear weapons altogether. Few experts saw this coming, and yet it wasn't long before most of those who didn't see it coming grew convinced they knew exactly why it had happened and what was coming next. For liberals, it all made perfect sense. The Soviet economy was crumbling, and a new cohort of Soviet leaders was weary of the wasteful struggle with the United States. "We can't go on living this way," Gorbachev said to his wife, Raisa, the day before his ascension to power. It was bound to happen. So it wasn't all that surprising when you look at it in the right retrospective light. And no, Reagan didn't deserve credit. If anything, his evil empire rhetoric had shored up the Kremlin old guard and delayed the inevitable. For conservatives, too, the explanation was obvious. Reagan had called the Soviets bluff by upping the arms race ante, and now Gorbachev was folding. It was all predictable when you viewed it in the right retrospective light. My inner cynic started to suspect that no matter what had happened, the experts would have been just as adept at downplaying their predictive failures and sketching an arc of history that made it appear they saw it coming all along. After all, the world had just witnessed a huge surprise involving one of the most consequential matters imaginable. If this didn't induce a shiver of doubt, what would? I was not questioning the intelligence or integrity of these experts, many of whom had won big scientific prizes or held high government offices when I was in grade school. But intelligence and integrity are not enough. The national security elites looked a lot like the renowned physicians from the pre-scientific era. They too overflowed with intelligence and integrity. But tip-of-your-nose delusions can fool anyone, even the best and the brightest, perhaps especially the best and the brightest. Judging judgments. This got me thinking about expert forecasts. At lunch one day in 1988, my then Berkeley colleague Daniel Kahneman tossed out a testable idea that proved prescient. He speculated that intelligence and knowledge would improve forecasting, but the benefits would taper off fast. People armed with PhDs and decades of experience may be only a tad more accurate than attentive readers of the New York Times. Of course, Kahneman was just guessing, and even Kahneman guesses are just guesses. No one had ever seriously tested the forecasting accuracy of political experts, and the more I pondered the challenge, the more I realized why. Take the problem of timelines. Obviously, a forecast without a time frame is absurd. And yet, forecasters routinely make them, as they did in that letter to Ben Bernanke. They're not being dishonest, at least not usually. Rather, they're relying on a shared implicit understanding, however rough, of the timeline they have in mind. That's why forecasts without timelines don't appear absurd when they are made. But as time passes, memories fade, and tacit time frames that once seemed obvious to all become less so. The result is often a tedious dispute about the real meaning of the forecast. Was the event expected this year or next? This decade or next? With no time frame, there is no way to resolve these arguments to everyone's satisfaction, especially when reputations are on the line. This problem alone renders many everyday forecasts untestable. Similarly, forecasts often rely on implicit understandings of key terms rather than explicit definitions, like significant market share in Steve Ballmer's forecast. This sort of vague verbiage is more the rule than the exception, and it too renders forecasts untestable. These are among the smaller obstacles to judging forecasts. Probability is a much bigger one. Some forecasts are easy to judge because they claim unequivocally that something will or won't happen, as in Jonathan Schell's forecast for nuclear war. Either we get rid of nuclear weapons or a Holocaust will occur, Schell wrote. As it turned out, neither superpower scrapped its nuclear arsenal, and there was no nuclear war, neither in the year Schell's book appeared, nor in the next year. So Schell, read literally, was clearly wrong. But what if Schell had said it was very likely there would be nuclear war? Then it would be less clear. Schell might have grossly exaggerated the risk, or he might have been exactly right, and humanity was lucky to survive the most reckless game of Russian roulette ever played. The only way to settle this definitively would be to rerun history hundreds of times, and if civilization ends in piles of irradiated rubble in most of those reruns, we would know Schell was right. But we can't do that, so we can't know. But let's imagine we are omnipotent beings and we can conduct that experiment. We rerun history hundreds of times, and we find that 63% of those reruns end in nuclear war. Was Schell right? Perhaps. But we still can't say with confidence, because we don't know exactly what he meant by very likely. That may sound like a semantic quibble, but it is much more than that, as Sherman Kent discovered to his alarm. In intelligence circles, Sherman Kent is a legend. With a PhD in history, Kent left a faculty position at Yale to join the research and analysis branch of the newly created Coordinator of Information, COI, in 1941. The COI became the Office of Strategic Services, OSS. The OSS became the Central Intelligence Agency, CIA. By the time Kent retired from the CIA in 1967, he had profoundly shaped how the American intelligence community does what it calls intelligence analysis, the methodical examination of the information collected by spies and surveillance to figure out what it means and what will happen next. The key word in Kent's work is estimate. As Kent wrote, "Estimating is what you do when you do not know." And as Kent emphasized over and over, we never truly know what will happen next. Hence, forecasting is all about estimating the likelihood of something happening, which Kent and his colleagues did for many years at the Office of National Estimates, an obscure but extraordinarily influential bureau, whose job was to draw on all information available to the CIA, synthesize it, and forecast anything and everything that might help the top office holders in the U.S. government decide what to do next. Kent and his colleagues were far from perfect. Most notoriously, they published a 1962 estimate that argued the Soviets would not be so foolish as to deploy offensive missiles to Cuba, when, in fact, they already had. But for the most part, their estimates were well regarded because Kent upheld high standards of analytical rigor. In drafting national intelligence estimates, the stakes were high. Every word mattered. Kent weighed each one carefully. But not even Kent's professionalism could stop confusion from seeping in. In the late 1940s, the communist government of Yugoslavia broke from the Soviet Union, raising fears the Soviets would invade. In March 1951, National Intelligence Estimate, NIE, 29-51, was published. Although it is impossible to determine which course of action the Kremlin is likely to adopt, the report concluded, we believe that the extent of Eastern European military and propaganda preparations indicate that an attack on Yugoslavia in 1951 should be considered a serious possibility. By most standards, that is clear, meaningful language. No one suggested otherwise when the estimate was published and read by top officials throughout the government. But a few days later, Kent was chatting with a senior State Department official who casually asked, "By the way, what did you people mean by the expression, serious possibility? What kind of odds did you have in mind?" Kent said he was pessimistic. He felt the odds were about 65-35 in favor of an attack. The official was startled. He and his colleagues had taken serious possibility to mean much lower odds. Disturbed, Kent went back to his team. They had all agreed to use serious possibility in the NIE, so Kent asked each person in turn what he thought it meant. One analyst said it meant odds of about 80-20, or 4 times more likely than not that there would be an invasion. Another thought it meant odds of 20-80, exactly the opposite. Other answers were scattered between those extremes. Kent was floored. The phrase that looked informative was so vague as to be almost useless. Or perhaps it was worse than useless, as it had created dangerous misunderstandings. And what about all the other work they had done? Had they been seeming to agree on 5 months' worth of estimative judgments with no real agreement at all? Kent wrote in a 1964 essay. Were the NIEs dotted with serious possibilities and other expressions that meant very different things to both producers and readers? What were we really trying to say when we wrote a sentence such as this? Kent was right to worry. In 1961, when the CIA was planning to topple the Castro government by landing a small army of Cuban expatriates at the Bay of Pigs, President John F. Kennedy turned to the military for an unbiased assessment. The Joint Chiefs of Staff concluded that the plan had a fair chance of success. The man who wrote the words, fair chance, later said he had in mind odds of 3-1 against success. But Kennedy was never told precisely what fair chance meant, and, not unreasonably, he took it to be a much more positive assessment. Of course, we can't be sure that if the chiefs had said, "We feel it's a 3-1 the invasion will fail," that Kennedy would have called it off. But it surely would have made him think harder about authorizing what turned out to be an unmitigated disaster. Sherman Kent suggested a solution. First, the word possible should be reserved for important matters where analysts have to make a judgment, but can't reasonably assign any probability. So something that is possible has a likelihood ranging from almost 0 to almost 100%. Of course, that's not helpful, so analysts should narrow the range of their estimates whenever they can. And to avoid confusion, the terms they use should have designated numerical meanings, which Kent set out in a chart. Certainty, 100%. The general area of possibility, certain. 93%, give or take about 6%, almost certain. 75%, give or take about 12%, probable. 50%, give or take about 10%, chances about even. 30%, give or take about 10%, probably not. 7%, give or take about 5%, almost certainly not. 0%, impossible. So if the national intelligence estimate said something is probable, it would mean a 63% to 87% chance it would happen. Kent's scheme was simple, and it greatly reduced the room for confusion. But it was never adopted. People liked clarity and precision in principle, but when it came time to make clear and precise forecasts, they weren't so keen on numbers. Some said it felt unnatural or awkward, which it does when you've spent a lifetime using vague language. But that's a weak argument against change. Others expressed an aesthetic revulsion. Language has its own poetry, they felt, and it's tacky to talk explicitly about numerical odds. It makes you sound like a bookie. Kent wasn't impressed. "I'd rather be a bookie than a goddamn poet," was his legendary response. A more serious objection, then and now, is that expressing a probability estimate with a number may imply to the reader that it is an objective fact, not the subjective judgment it is. That is a danger. But the answer is not to do away with numbers. It's to inform readers that numbers, just like words, only express estimates, opinions, and nothing more. Similarly, it might be argued that the precision of a number implicitly says, the forecaster knows with exactitude that this number is right. But that's not intended and shouldn't be inferred. Also, bear in mind that words like serious possibility suggest the same thing numbers do, the only real difference being that numbers make it explicit, reducing the risk of confusion. And they have another benefit. Vague thoughts are easily expressed with vague language. But when forecasters are forced to translate terms like serious possibility into numbers, they have to think carefully about how they are thinking, a process known as metacognition. Forecasters who practice get better at distinguishing finer degrees of uncertainty, just as artists get better at distinguishing subtler shades of gray. But a more fundamental obstacle to adopting numbers relates to accountability, and what I call the wrong side of maybe fallacy. If a meteorologist says there is a 70% chance of rain, and it doesn't rain, is she wrong? Not necessarily. Implicitly, her forecast also says there is a 30% chance it will not rain. So if it doesn't rain, her forecast may have been off, or she may have been exactly right. It's not possible to judge with only that one forecast in hand. The only way to know for sure would be to rerun the day hundreds of times. If it rained in 70% of those reruns, and didn't rain in 30%, she would be bang on. Of course, we're not omnipotent beings, so we can't rerun the day, and we can't judge. But people do judge, and they always judge the same way. They look at which side of maybe, 50%, the probability was on. If the forecast said there was a 70% chance of rain and it rains, people think the forecast was right. If it doesn't rain, they think it was wrong. This simple mistake is extremely common. Even sophisticated thinkers fall for it. In 2012, when the Supreme Court was about to release its long-awaited decision on the constitutionality of Obamacare, prediction markets, markets that let people bet on possible outcomes, pegged the probability of the law being struck down at 75%. When the court upheld the law, the sagacious New York Times reporter, David Leonhardt, declared that the market, the wisdom of the crowds, was wrong. The prevalence of this elementary error has a terrible consequence. Consider that if an intelligence agency says there is a 65% chance that an event will happen, it risks being pilloried if it does not. And because the forecast itself says there is a 35% chance it will not happen, that's a big risk. So what's the safe thing to do? Stick with elastic language. Forecasters who use a fair chance and a serious possibility can even make the wrong side of maybe fallacy work for them. If the event happens, a fair chance can retroactively be stretched to mean something considerably bigger than 50%. So the forecaster nailed it. If it doesn't happen, it can be shrunk to something smaller than 50%. And again, the forecaster nailed it. With perverse incentives like these, it's no wonder people prefer rubbery words over firm numbers. Kent couldn't overcome such political barriers, but as the years passed, the case he made for using numbers only grew. Study after study showed that people attach very different meanings to probabilistic language like could, might, and likely. Still, the intelligence community resisted. Only after the debacle over Saddam Hussein's supposed weapons of mass destruction and the wholesale reforms that followed did it become more acceptable to express probabilities with numbers. When CIA analysts told President Obama they were 70% or 90% sure the mystery man in a Pakistani compound was Osama bin Laden, it was a small, posthumous triumph for Sherman Kent. In some other fields, numbers have become standard. Slight chance of showers has given way to 30% chance of showers in weather forecasts. But hopelessly vague language is still so common, particularly in the media, that we rarely notice how vacuous it is. It just slips by. I think the debt crisis in Europe is unresolved and may be very close to going critical, the Harvard economic historian and popular commentator Neil Ferguson told an interviewer in January 2012. The Greek default may be a matter of days away. Was Ferguson right? The popular understanding of default involves a complete repudiation of debt, and Greece didn't do that days, months, or years later. But there's also a technical definition of default, which Greek did shortly after Ferguson's forecast. Which definition was Ferguson using? That's not clear. So while there's a reason to think Ferguson was right, we can't be certain. But let's imagine there was no default of any kind. Could we then say Ferguson was wrong? No. He only said Greece may default, and may is a hollow word. It means something is possible, but it says nothing about the probability of that possibility. Almost anything may happen. I can confidently forecast that the Earth may be attacked by aliens tomorrow. And if it isn't, I'm not wrong. Every may is accompanied by an asterisk. And the words or may not are buried in the fine print. But the interviewer didn't notice the fine print in Ferguson's forecast, so we did not ask him to clarify. If we are serious about measuring and improving, this won't do. Forecasts must have clearly defined terms and timelines. They must use numbers. And one more thing is essential. We must have lots of forecasts. We cannot rerun history, so we cannot judge one probabilistic forecast. But everything changes when we have many probabilistic forecasts. If a meteorologist says there is a 70% chance of rain tomorrow, that forecast cannot be judged. But if she predicts the weather tomorrow and the day after that for months, her forecasts can be tabulated and her track record determined. If her forecasting is perfect, rain happens 70% of the time when she says there is 70% chance of rain, 30% of the time when she says there is 30% chance of rain, and so on. This is called calibration. It can be plotted on a simple chart. Perfect calibration is captured by the diagonal line on this chart. If the meteorologist's curve is far above the line, She is underconfident. So things she says are 20% likely actually happen 50% of the time. See opposite page top. If her curve is far under the line, she is overconfident. So things she says are 80% likely actually happen